generally speaking, conditions haven't improved on the whole. At best, potentially some piecemeal initiatives. I think there are some pressures that are probably felt even more acutely this year than compared to last year. Certainly, the inflationary pressures on wages and the cost of living in an already low-waged sector will have made that even worse. For people, for example, who do home support work, and so there is travel costs associated with that. I suspect that the price of gas, as it has been over the last year, will have made that increasingly difficult and not manageable. So, and any efforts that have happened, I don't think will have really got to the heart of the undervaluing that happens in the sector.
The write-up for the Valuing Care Work Summit this week says, we cannot continue to rely on the compassion of caregivers to fill the gaps in essential care service. In practice, what does it mean for workers in this mostly female workforce for the sector to fuel itself on their compassion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think it's really important to highlight the gendered and really the racialized element of this across both the paid care sector and the unpaid care sector. So the thing that's tricky about care work, and this is not exclusive to care for older adults and adults with disabilities, but also holds true for child care as well, is that when we try to do this in a market model, right, where we buy and sell this like a private service, care doesn't really follow what classic economics would suggest in terms of supply and demand. So as availability of services becomes scarcer, right, because demand is high, it's not like people have fewer care needs. Those care needs don't go away. And so there is an inherent relationship between paid care work and unpaid care work. So the more unattainable, either because costs go up or availability goes down, so the more unattainable care services are, it just means the more people, predominantly women, so either daughters, mothers, grandmothers, neighbors, will do this work in an unpaid capacity, impacting their own ability to participate within the economy and their own ability to fully utilize their own skills in the economy. So it's not just about the paid care workers. It absolutely is. But part of the undervaluing that happens is because we rely on women to do this work in a paid and unpaid capacity. And when the state makes these services unavailable, or what we would say retrenches, right? So rather than making these services more widely accessible to everyone, if we narrow down the availability, so we're still paying the same amount for care, but there's more people that need care, so there's less per person, people find other ways to support their family members, to support the people in their lives who need care. It just happens by a different group of undervalued, non-visible labor. And so this is part of the reason why care is so tricky and so undervalued, is because it doesn't comply with what we would normally think of as supply and demand models. And because people are unwilling to let their family members go without care, this work gets done anyways. And so as a result of this undervaluing, women, both in a paid capacity for those who work in the sector and women who do this work in an unpaid capacity for family members or neighbors and in the community, are subsidizing the fragile state of public provision of care.
Your new research involves international comparison study. What countries did you look at as part of these international comparisons?
So we focused predominantly on what we would refer to as liberal market economies, so places that have a similar market orientation, a mix of public and private provision, similar aging populations. And so as a result, we looked at the UK, and in specific, because healthcare and social care are devolved matters of the Scottish Parliament. We looked at Scotland and England, a little bit at Wales. We also looked very closely at Australia and New Zealand. So those were our big comparators. We also did look at other provinces as well. And again, this wasn't an exhaustive review, but rather a purposive review. We were looking for places that were having interesting and relevant conversations that line up with things that we could take back to New Brunswick, right? And so we looked at British Columbia, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia within Canada. And so, interestingly, in our international comparisons, the ones that we tend to focus most closely on are Scotland and New Zealand. So in Scotland, since 2015, I believe, they have had an independent body called the Fair Work Convention. It's an advisory to government. It is appointed by government, but it is made up of employers, of union representatives, and of academic representatives. So it really is a social partnership, and it advises on issues related to fair and decent work in Scotland. And they have paid very close attention to the social care sector because it is some of the most undervalued and, again, heavily dominated by women and objectively poor quality work in terms of how the work is designed. And because it is publicly funded, so not necessarily delivered by the public sector, but paid for through public money, there are levers that the government can and should do to think about improving work in this space. So it's a space that they have the capacity to act in compared to other sectors of the economy. So Scotland has the Fair Work Convention in Scotland undertook a significant review of the sector, which was then followed up by a government independent commission of the social care sector, which more or less unanimously adopted their recommendations, among which were to look at procurement and tendering. It's all of us taxpayers that are paying for these services. And so this is an important question about who's paying for what, and actually what does it mean to work in that sector? Why can't people in outsourced providers, why can't they also have access to a pension plan? If that's something that's really important to workers that work in the sector, how do we make sure that we as the taxpayer are also recognizing the full cost of delivering that service, rather than just using outsourcing as a mechanism to drive down costs?
I think that that's been a, you know, very broadly speaking, part of the process of, you know, what are often called neoliberal reforms in countries like Canada, England, United States, where more services are outsourced, given to private contractors to, as you say, reduce government expenditure. And then the costs get, you know, borne somewhere. The buck has to stop somewhere, and that may mean that these women don't get a pension.
That's right. But at the end of the day, what it also means is that people don't want to stay working in the sector, right? So you kind of, what's the expression? You cut off your nose to spite your face. And that's what's quite interesting about the debates in Scotland and New Zealand. And that's not to say they're getting everything right and that they fix the problem and that they have wonderful social care and high wages or anything like that. No, they are still very much in the midst of grappling with these kinds of issues. But it is about dealing with those consequences of those neoliberal practices, right? The retrenchment of the state that we have seen, and saying, actually, it's not working. And if we are going to continue outsourcing, which is a different debate about whether or not we should, right? Should we actually take these services back into the public sector? That's one set of debates. Some would argue that there are some very interesting providers that are able to provide very niche, high-quality services under this model. So that's up for discussion.